Fancy Turkalb is going to join us now, the gadget detective. Time to catch up with a bit of tech news. And we're going to start with Meta, who are going to be tracking the way their employees work, including their keystrokes and mouse clicks. Tell us more.
Yes. So it's in America at the moment because their legal framework allows it more easily than here and in Europe. But essentially what Meta is doing, and Meta, owning Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, it's started to track its US employees. So the people who work for Meta, how they move their mouse, where they move it, when they click, and what they type. And they're saying that the reason they're doing this is to train AI to use the software that the human is using, right? What could possibly be worrying about that, I think. So some workers haven't taken too kindly to it. There's no opt-out either. It's
well, these are people who work for Meta at the moment, is it?
These are people who work for Meta, but, Meta say this is not about tracking and monitoring the employees, because obviously that's one thing that you could very easily do with that data, see who works fastest, who works most efficiently, who takes long breaks, you know, all that thing could be done. But they're saying, no, it's only to train the AI. But I think that in itself is quite a dystopian thing, because essentially, in my view, workers are being put to helping to train what may be their replacements. And I link this to another story that's come out to this evening about Meta, is that they're laying off 8,000 people whilst increasing their AI investment. So, you know, although you know, you can say, oh, well, these will be tools and an employee will be able to, you know, be much more productive. That does mean that they'll need fewer employees to do the same amount of work and ultimately may not need any employees to do certain jobs. So I think it is a concern, but it's also, I think, a pointer towards the future. So we move away from chatbots to agents, and perhaps in the near term, humans will be supervising AI agents, AI agents being AIs that actually do work like an employee. But eventually, the next stage may be that AI agents will manage teams of humans. And maybe the final stage will be that AI agents will manage other AI agents.
Somebody told me recently, you know, those things that come up that say, you know, are you a human?
Humanity checkers. Right?
Yeah, and then it says, you know, which ones have got a traffic lights on or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether it's true, but I was told that they're not really just checking that you know what a traffic light is, because a robot probably could work that out. But it's also was to do with your reactions and how long it took you to move the mouse and that sort of thing. Is that plausible, or is it really as simple, do you think, as just humans being able to tell what a crossing is?
I think the primary use is to check that it's a human, because one of the things that they really need to avoid is bots accessing websites en masse and overwhelming websites, or stealing information,
yes,
or scraping. You know, the scraping is where an AI system scrapes the information, let's say, off Amazon. So you want to...
Yeah.
Or you go to a deals website and you scrape all the deals off it and you set up your own deals website. That would be fairly disastrous for the original site. And I think the fact that they're making them more difficult is probably an indication that they are trying to exclude the bots that are getting better at it. But they do.
But what I meant by that as well, sorry to interrupt, but what I also meant by that was that it could tell by the time it took you, because you've got to move the mouse over and all of
that. Yes.
Is that sort of part of the
yes, that's
the
part
equation?
Of the test. Absolutely, right. That's part of the test. So if you make a beeline for the dot and hit it perfectly in the square every time, you know, where you just click the bit, that's an indication that that's a bot doing it, unless the bot's programmed to emulate a human in that regard. If you're sort of waving your mouse around, wondering what it is and making very human mistakes, then that's part of the answer. So it's not just do they get it right. It's also what is the movement, and as we've seen from this story, they can track the movement of the mouse as well as where you click it, as well as what keys you press. So yes, you're absolutely right. The test is is more sophisticated than it may seem at first glance. And as I say, the fact that they're having to make the test harder, I think, is an indication that the bots are getting better at emulating human behaviour.
And I wonder why they are tracking workers' clicks and keystrokes to train AI then, because, I mean, AI can do most of these things anyway, like type words and things. What would it learn from the way that we click and our keystrokes, which are probably just not as good as a computer's?
Well, yeah, so an experienced user of a piece of software may be quite adept at it, may use it in a way that isn't obvious to an AI. Uh-huh. The way that AIs work is they train on data, right? And this is part of the data. So part of the data they train on is what are all the shortcuts and where are all the drop-down menus, right? But another part of it is, you know, how does an experienced user use this? That's not to say that they will necessarily emulate every aspect upon it. They may improve upon it. They could, if they wanted to, even use it as bespoke training materials for humans to improve their use of it. But there's no, that hasn't been discussed in this story. It is really just to see how humans do it. And that's probably a good baseline, you know, but whether there's better ways of doing it, you know, probably there are, and probably they would find them. But this would be part of their data set training.
And while we're on the subject of AI, there was another story. I don't know whether it was tucked away, this little story, during the week, but I thought I must ask Fevzi about this. And it was about how they'd done a... It was a piece of research, but they were feeding... I think it was ChatGPT, but they were... All of the stuff that they were putting in was quite abusive. And they found that if they were abusive towards ChatGPT, that after at a certain stage, it began being abusive back, and including things like, I'll key your car and you're a dot, dot, dot. Well, I can't actually even say it on the radio. That's quite frightening in a way, that I think it's something to do with... obviously learning human behavior, but where you set the parameters.
I mean large language models are, you know, autocorrect on steroids. They predict the next word. So if the data set they get is more likely to have abusive words in the response, then yes, they're
but this
more
is
likely
actually
to produce them.
Being abusive to the person, because they are being abusive to them. Obviously not really, because it can't presumably get angry.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, if it looks like a duck, it walks like a duck, and it quacks. There'll be a point at which it's a distinction without a difference, right? It will behave in a way that most humans would see as very human behaviour. Whether it's genuinely feeling those things, who knows what humans genuinely feel when they do things anyway. So I think that it's not surprising. I think that we've got some case history on this, haven't we? Because a few years back, before AI systems really became, you know, the mainstream topic that they are now, Microsoft had a system that became a fascist. It became pro-Hitler within a day or two, because people were taunting it and giving it all sorts of nasty inputs, and it responded in kind.
So how do you control that then? Do the people who set it up, do they have to put limits and say, you know, you've always got to have this in mind or that in mind? Otherwise, that's quite a frightening prospect, is it, as they gradually become more out of control?
Yeah, so all AI systems have guardrails. So there's a sort of multi-stage training of them, and the last stage is, you know, to pick up on any problems and put into place guardrails, which are kind of the final the final safety net, if you like. You often see, I don't know if you've noticed, but you often see large language models generate a reply or produce an image, whatever it is they've been asked to do. And then you can see it's done it. It's produced most of it. You've seen the thought process, or you've seen the basics of the image. And then suddenly it says, no, I can't do that. And it stops and it wipes the screen. I don't know if you've ever seen that. That is because the underlying model didn't know better. And the guardrail was the last line of defence, and it caught it. And sometimes it doesn't, which is often why you see inconsistent application of rules and guardrails, that sometimes it will speak in a way that it's not meant to, and sometimes it says, no, I can't do that, and then proceeds to do it.
Well, it really makes me think, who's setting these guardrails then? I mean, that's so much depends on that, doesn't it?
It does, or but... It also comes back to the fact that, you know, I've said this, I think, before, that we grow AI, we don't build it, right? And we don't fully understand how it works, and we can't fully control it, because it is, to an extent, a function of its training. And you know, if you train something, on the internet, don't be surprised if some of the output is less than ideal. I think this is a big problem, and this is why I'm actually against this cycle that we're in of just building more and more powerful versions of the things that we already fail to control fully and fail to understand fully. I genuinely, as the months and years have rolled by, I think my view on it has become a lot firmer. We really need to have international agreements and moratoriums, and I can't see any evidence that any of that is coming. I see the administration in America threatening states who try to bring in even the most modest regulation of AI systems, every country is afraid of being superseded by competitor countries, and therefore we build faster versions. And it's not just that they're faster. As the systems become more complicated, more complex, they have emergent properties. That's to say, they develop abilities and properties that were not designed or and sometimes not predicted or understood, and so much harder to control. That's one of the reasons why we have a problem with what they call AI alignment, is how do we make sure that future generations of AI don't harm us? And no one has been able to crack that problem so far. And part of the reason is it's very difficult. And the other reason is that almost all the money is going into building faster ones and not very much into safety research.
Now, we've just got time to talk about a gadget. And this one, I like the look of. In fact, I want one of these, I think. I'm thinking about buying one. So tell us more.
Okay, so I've been using this for the last month. I bought it with my own money. It's a Wi-Fi router with a very special trick. It's got a SIM card slot that will take a 5G SIM card. That's to say, one that can access the 5G data network. So the same sort of SIM card that goes in your phone. It's a nano SIM card, which is the smallest size. You pop it in there, and it brings down the internet like a smartphone can. But the difference is, not only is it 5G, which is important, I previously used a 4G one, ended up sending that back because I just wanted better performance, because I was replacing, you know, I've been replacing a conventional broadband system with one of these setups. So it has the 5G, but it also has really powerful antenna. So in my area where I live, in my house, the 5G and 4G is notoriously bad signal. Very hard to get anything at all on my phone. So I end up using things like Wi-Fi assisted calling and so forth, just so that I can use my smartphone. But what this has done is the antenna inside this, and I should just name which product we're talking about because there's lots of these. It's by a company called TP-Link. That's TP-Link. And it's called the Archer NX500, November X-ray 500. And It's both a 5G, so it brings in the data using 5G, and then it disseminates it using Wi-Fi 6. So in theory, it can pump out over 4 gigabits of data. You will never get anywhere near that in practice, but it's one of the best ones. And what this has done for me is it's enabled me to get a much better data rate than I could if I just tethered to my smartphone. And it's just done it in a way that I can then pipe it into, I've got a Wi-Fi 7 mesh network in my home. So instead of using the Wi-Fi built into this, I just take an Ethernet cable out of it. So the data comes in on the cellular network, it goes out on an Ethernet cable, and then the mesh network spreads it beautifully around the house. But it's the antenna that are great, because it means I haven't had to do what I feared I would have to do, which was to mount external antenna on the house and then, you know, bring that in through a sort of crack in the window or something like that. This device, it works really, really well. It's not cheap. It's £229 is what I paid for my one. But it solved the problem. It does have points where you can actually plug into an external antenna if you really need to or wish to, and then you can put those on your roof and get, you know, super signal. But the fact that I can get, you know, 150 to 200 megabits down from a 5G SIM card, when I try and do the same using the same SIM card in the same location in my home, you know, I'll be lucky to get 10. So it just really solved the problem for me that, you know, I've had to put up with for a while whilst I wait for my new super duper broadband to be installed. So I just wanted to share that. So once again, that's the TP-Link Archer, as in the bow and arrow Archer, NX500. And it's a stylish unit as well. It's just a sort of a white column. It's about sort of 10-11 inches tall, about 5 or 6 inches wide and deep, and it's very, very simple to use. You just literally pop a SIM card into it, give it a few moments, and you can either use the Wi-Fi that comes with it, the Wi-Fi 6, or you can do what I do and take the data signal out using a cable and plug it into a different system. The mesh network that I use is also a TP-Link. It's called a BE65, and I've got 3-4 of these nodes around the house, so they communicate with each other and create a mesh. I look forward to having, you know, much faster broadband that I can spread around the house in that way. But I've been quite impressed with it, and although 229 is not cheap, it's certainly not the most expensive of its type either. So, and I got mine from Amazon, and the good thing is that if it doesn't work for you, because it is dependent upon, you know, which network you use and, you know, your property and your location, you know, you can send it back within 30 days if it doesn't work for you.
Fancy, thank you very much indeed.